Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, December 12th, 2018. We begin with the news section. Silent Sam Shrine. UNC doesn't want the Confederate monument, but it can't figure out how to get rid of it either. When the Board of Trustees for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill announced a proposal to build a new $5.3 million history and education center to house the toppled Confederate monument known as Silent Sam last week, reactions were swift and overwhelmingly negative. Trustees were responding to a request from the UNC Board of Governors, which oversees the UNC system, for a lawful and lasting path that protects public safety, preserves the monument and its history, and allows the university to focus on its core mission of education, research, economic stimulation, and creating the next generation of scholars. Their solution? Build a new facility on the fringe of campus to house Silent Sam and teach the university's history. On social media and in public statements, students and alumni likened this new building to a shrine for Silent Sam and the white supremacy it stands for. At least 1,100 alumni have pledged to withhold donations until Silent Sam is permanently removed from the campus. Teaching assistants, and faculty members went on strike, withholding thousands of final grades and threatening not to teach when the spring semester begins if the Board of Governors approves the trustees' recommendation. The BOG is expected to consider the matter during its December 14th meeting. Critics will likely find much more to be upset about in the appendices that accompanied the proposal, which detail the recommendations of security professionals the university asked to weigh the safety implications of restoring the monument. Among the panel's suggestions, a system-wide mobile police force to prevent or respond to civil disorder and violence at the future campus event. UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Felt has said that public safety was her top priority in handling the monument. Taken together, the trustees' proposal and the safety panel's recommendations suggest that controlling protests is part and parcel of that goal. The panel comprised five law enforcement officials who evaluated the general security climate on campus. The specific security challenge presented by the monument and the large-scale protests involving opposing factors that it attracts and specific alternative locations for the monument from a public safety and security standpoint. The panel concluded, and trustees agreed, that returning the monument to its previous spot in McCorkle Plaza would be dangerous. During last Monday's trustees meeting, Folt repeatedly said that she and the board would prefer to move the artifacts, Silent Sam, which protesters tore down on August the 20th, and bronze plaques that adorn its base, which still stands off campus, but she couldn't because of a state law passed in 2015. The university is being cautious in its reading of the law, which restricts the relocation of objects of remembrance. Under the law, the North Carolina Historical Commission must approve any relocation, meaning the trustees will also need that body's approval to bring its proposal to fruition. The law allows for objects to be moved to preserve them or to make way for construction, but mandates that they be relocated to a site of similar prominence, honor, visibility, availability, and access that are within the boundaries of the jurisdiction from which it was relocated. UNC trustees plan to build the History and Education Center at a former student housing site known as Odom Village on the southern edge of campus. It may not seem like a similarly prominent location to McCorkle Place, but UNC General Counsel Mark Merritt says it would be a hub of growth on campus, and it's near a planned light rail stop. Still, there are potential optics problems. The site is near a synagogue, and according to the UNC Black Student Movement, it is a significant location for black students to live and congregate. Asked why trustees believe the monument can't be moved off campus, UNC spokeswoman Joanne Peters Denny directed the Indy to a passage in the trustees' report that states that, by keeping the monument on campus, there can be no question that it remains within the boundaries of the jurisdiction from which it was relocated. The trustees did not, apparently, consider leaving Silent Sam where it is now, even though, as the report notes, most people who wrote to us said they want the monument permanently removed or moved to a location either off campus or within a contextualized setting on campus. Doing so would conflict both with state law and with the Board of Governors' request for a plan that preserves the monument, Denny said. I understand there are strong emotions about this proposal, Fole tweeted last week. As the nation's first public university, Carolina has a long and complicated history we must tell. We are recommending to build a center to tell all of that history, which includes the Confederate Monument. A new state-of-the-art building was the best solution from a security standpoint. The safety experts concluded that, and the majority of trustees agreed that would also best satisfy the law and the Board of Governors. Last Monday, all but two trustees present voted for the plan despite the safety panel's own assessment that the university faces a high risk of violence, civil disorder, and property damage if the monument is restored to campus, and that the risk to campus safety can be mitigated but not eliminated by placing Silent Sam in a newly constructed building. The new facility would also allow the university to place more restrictions on protest over the monument. While McCorkle Place is a public space, where only narrow time, place, and manner restrictions, for example, you can't block traffic, on speech could be imposed, the History and Education Center would likely be considered a non-public place where the university could impose content-neutral restrictions, such as limiting hours of visitation, crowd size, and regulating what items can be brought in, or requiring visitors to go through scanners or bag checks. Citing the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators, the safety panel says on-campus protests are becoming more volatile across the country, and few campus police departments, including UNC police, are equipped to handle them. The greatest risk, the panel said, is the threat of violence by extremist elements embedded inside protest and counter-protest groups. They know this because they researched the backgrounds of individual protesters and found most were not affiliated with the university. It's unclear how the panel decided whom to research. Denny says that she no longer has information the trust's publicly available proposal. To that end, the panel recommends a mobile force composed of 40 officers that could be deployed to any of the 17 UNC campuses across the state. The panel estimates the force would require about $500,000 equipment plus $2 million in annual operating costs. It also suggests UNC police expand its crowd control, protest management, and intelligence gathering capabilities. According to the report, UNC has already begun the process of making necessary changes to enhance the capability of the UNC police in these important respects. The department currently has 79 officers covering the 729-acre main Chapel Hill campus, 40,000 UNC community members, and satellite locations. UNC police have mutual aid agreements with about a dozen agencies. The safety panel says support from other agencies is tenuous, noting that Chapel Hill and Carrboro police can't be counted on to help protect the monument. The recommendations come after much scrutiny over how UNC police and supporting agencies have handled protesters in McCorkle Place. In a recent Silent Sam demonstration, UNC enlisted the help of the Greensboro Police Department's Civil Emergency Unit, whose officers protected members of a neo-Confederate group and pepper-sprayed and rammed bicycles into counter-protesters. Last year, Silent Sam protesters discovered an undercover UNC officer had been monitoring to them and lying about his identity. It's unclear if the Board of Governors will also consider the Safety Panel's mobile force recommendation when it takes up the trustees' proposal for the History and Education Center. The trustees clearly think it's important. As the proposal notes, "We believe that this recommendation warrants serious consideration and review by the Board of Governors." Now from the Soapboxer section, how to steal an election. Forget voter ID. This is what real election fraud looks like. There's no small irony to the fact that the same week lame duck Republicans conjured up their solution to a voter fraud problem that doesn't exist, the world got a close-up look at what actual election fraud looks like in North Carolina. Last month, of course, voters approved a details-free constitutional amendment requiring residents to produce a photo ID to vote. On Thursday, the General Assembly, where Republicans have veto-proof supermajorities for just a few more weeks, put meat on the bone, passing a voter ID bill crafted to avoid running afoul of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which denounced their last attempt as targeting African Americans with almost surgical precision. The 2013 iteration used racial data to exclude forms of ID commonly used by African Americans. Senate Bill 824 permits a wider range of IDs, including a new free ID card that local election boards can issue. Those who lack ID will have to vote provisionally and then either file an affidavit claiming a reasonable impediment to obtaining an ID or present their ID to the county election board before the results are certified. SB 824 and the amendment that enabled it followed years of hyperventilation over the supposed evil of voter fraud, which the data shows is an exceedingly rare bird. A state audit conducted after the 2016 election found that voter ID would have prevented exactly one illegal vote out of nearly 5 million votes cast. In other words, this is a pointless endeavor, except if the point is to place another obstacle in front of brown and black voters. The upside? Despite the intent, voter ID doesn't appear to be all that effective in suppressing turnout. While Republicans have obsessed about voter impersonation, which, again, is virtually non-existent, they've gotten considerably less hot and bothered about absentee voter fraud, perhaps because absentee voters tend to support Republicans. In 2013, legislative Republicans rejected a proposal to tighten absentee ballot restrictions, and it took the massive scandal brewing in the 9th Congressional District to convince them to even feign interest in the matter. A last-minute amendment to SB 824 takes county election boards with figuring out some way to require absentee voters to show ID. It's unclear whether that requirement would have prevented the possible fraud we're seeing in 9th District, where Charlotte political operative McCray Dowless Jr., who previously served time for insurance fraud, was hired to run an absentee ballot initiative for Republican Mark Harris, a fundamentalist preacher who has proclaimed that women should do what their husbands tell them and that Islam is the spawn of Satan. Harris's campaign paid the consulting firm Red Dome Group which contracted with Dowless $525,000 during this election cycle. Reporters reported that on Friday. Dowless delivered. When the ballots were counted, Harris was ahead of the Democrat Dan McCreary by about 900 votes, a margin attributable to Harris' success with absentee voters in Bladen and Robeson counties. But then, in a stunning move, the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement refused to certify the results. Over the last week, it became clear why. Something fishy went on. In Bladen County, for example, Harris won 61% of absentee votes, even though registered Republicans only accounted for 19% of accepted absentee ballots. In both Bladen and Robeson, an unusually high number of voters requested absentee ballots but didn't return them. The ballots that were returned overwhelmingly supported Harris, 96% in fact, in Bladen County. Dallas employees appear to have descended on low-income apartment complexes and gotten people to fill out absentee ballot request forms. When the ballots came back, the employees offered to take the voters' unsealed ballots and mail them, which is illegal. Dallas and Harris have both denied wrongdoing. But a new election, either called by the State Election Board or the U.S. House, seems increasingly likely. The evidence is so overwhelming that even Dallas Woodhouse, the head of the state GOP, has signaled an openness to a new election. Here's a crazy thing Republicans have warned about Dallas month ago. After U.S. Representative Robert Pittenger lost the May primary to Harris by 828 votes, again, thanks in part to Dallas' absentee efforts, he reportedly told GOP officials of his concern about ballot stuffing in Bladen County, but the party did nothing. And that's one of the more revelatory details about this sordid affair. Despite their years of dire warnings about stolen elections, state Republicans, when confronted with credible allegations of actual fraud, looked the other way. Winning the seat was far more important. What makes you think maybe, just maybe, all of that voter fraud-related caterwauling wasn't entirely on the level? Now, this week's feature article, the Indies Arts Award. Art of the State. We celebrate six people whom we can't imagine life in the Triangle without. The editorial lead into this. The Indy always strives to support the arts in the Triangle, even while we scrutinize and criticize them. But for almost three decades now, in one of our favorite annual issues, we take a moment to pause and simply celebrate a group of people who had a notable impact on the arts, either that year or over time. People whose work is so fundamentally important that it can often be taken for granted. The Indy Awards, Arts Awards, vividly capture what mattered in the Triangle in a given year. Rooted in the arts, but also transcending them, they open into political and social realms. The story of the Triangle's art workers and leaders always turns out to be the story of the Triangle itself, and it's inspiring to see afresh how much of the arts matters and how amazing the people powering them here are. The winners we choose for these awards often must be convinced to accept the spotlight for a moment, rather than sharing the reward with their entire creative community. This says a lot about why we select them in the first place. All of them, whether as creators, producers, administrators, or in other roles, serve those around them as much or more than they serve themselves. All of them understand that, to matter, art must be a kind of community service, not a vanity project. And that means, first, knowing what one means by community, and second, actually listening to what they want. We are incredibly grateful to exist in the same creative ecosystem as people like this year's winners, performance art pioneer Monet Moelle Marshall, women's comedy impresario Aaron Terry, theater revolutionary Jamaica Holloway Burrell, powerhouse poet Jackie Shelton Green, Durham lifestyle leader Gabrielle Engs-Getz, and transformative NCMA director Larry Wheeler. We know this is a humble honor for us to write profiles of them and take their pictures, but we're thankful we get the chance to tell them without qualification how much they mean to us and how much they mean to this area for making life in the Triangle richer, more equitable, better. We hope you'll be inspired to reach out and tell them the same thing yourself and to follow their example in your daily lives. We know we do, and we invite you to remember with us that the arts matter, but we all must work together to make them better for everyone. Performance art. Monet Noel Marshall's many roles all served uplift black art. Monet Noel Marshall's presence in a room is always felt. She moves through spaces fluidly with a calm spirit of humility and wisdom. Even when she is seemingly alone, she stands as 10,000, as Maya Angelou would say. "This is more than Monet getting an award," she says. "There are so many people that, because they exist, I'm able to exist, make, and do." She means her family, her friends, and frequent collaborators, people like Derek Beasley, whose real title in her shows, she said, should be, "Monet calls me, and I show up." Marsha's work spans many mediums and genres, community art experiences, choreography and dance, and bringing stories to life through the pen and on stage. Her artistry even comes forth in a simple conversation. The poetry in her words, her unique sense of style, and her bold ideas embody the essence of what it means to be an artist. "I really feel like I didn't have a choice but to be an artist," says Marshall, whose mother, the playwright, choreographer, and director Robin Cameron Marshall, is one of her biggest inspirations. "My mother led a dance ministry at a church in New York, and she was the leader of 30 to 40 women. One night for rehearsal, she came in and washed all their feet. It was a really deep impact on how I thought about leadership." Years later, in 2013, Marshall founded MOJOAA, Performing Arts Company, with her family. Her mother co-directs, her dad serves as producer, actor, and playwright, and her brothers give support on stage and backstage. MOJOAA was created in response to the lack of black theater companies in the Triangle. It became a steward of history through interactive storytelling. The Escape to Freedom is an annual immersive experience at Mordecai Historic Park, the largest former plantation in Wake County. It takes audiences on the journey to escape slavery during the antebellum period. Marshall learned early that art exists in community and should not be saved for exhibitions and museums. "Church is not the building, it's the people. I want our arts institutions to move the same," she said. "I care less about the painting or the show. What did it do for people? If the answer is nothing, then what is actually the point of it?" The use of art to create shared space is a thread through all of Marshall's projects, including this year's Buy It, Call It performance installations. The trilogy is Marshall's response to the systemic oppression black artists encounter in the art world, the toll of capitalism on their minds and bodies, and the process of reclaiming one's holiness and self-worth. Creating three experimental performances that challenged white supremacy in art spaces was a bold decision resulting in necessary honest dialogue. Her organizing and interdisciplinary performance work demand that people unpack how patriarchy and act blackness show up in their public and private selves. After exploring arts institutions, commodification of black art and buy my soul and call it art, then revealing the impact of racial trauma and shame on her body in Buy My Body and Call It a Ticket, Marsha moved even further beyond traditional stage performance in Buy My Art and Call It Holy, which is ongoing this week. A 10-day experience for communities to connect in freedom, movement, and authenticity. Its main space at the former Old Favana Sandwich Shop is built to feel like home, or, as Marshall told us, her future kitchen as a queer black grandma who serves you freshly baked bread and tea. Next, comedy clout. Stand-up here has long been a man's world. With Eyes Up Here, Erin Terry is changing that. As she approached her 30th birthday, Erin Terry decided to do something she'd never done before, stand-up comedy. She'd always been a funny person, the kind of person friends asked to retell a funny story that happened to all of them, but she didn't think of herself as a comedian. I really had tried hard to ignore my leanings to get on stage and talk and try to make people laugh for a long time, Terry said. She knew some acquaintances doing open mics. She thought she was funnier. That was the activation she needed. I decided that before I turned 30, I was going to get on stage and do a routine. She watched stand-up routines online. She practiced with a hairbrush in front of her mirror. For her first open mic in February of 2014 at Raleigh's Tiernanog, she invited all of her friends and family. That way, she knew somebody would laugh. The real test, she said, came the next month when she did another set for a room full of strangers. When they laughed at her jokes, she knew that she was hooked. It took her only a few months to notice how male-dominated the scene was. Shows rarely featured more than one female comic, if any. But she'd already met lots of women doing comedy in the Triangle. Why aren't they getting the same stage time? I started asking the women on the scene, "How do you get booked?" Terry said. "Are there any shows that do more than one woman at a time? How do we tell them that there is a room for more than just one woman?" She didn't think the men were being intentionally malicious. She attributed the discrepancy to a gross oversight on their part. Through her conversations with these women comedians, one thing became apparent. They could run their own show by women, featuring women. That way, Terry said, we can all shine a bit more instead of trying to duke it out one at a time. To get an audience, Terry decided to do the show on First Friday in downtown Raleigh. She booked 7 comedians, a tall lineup. The now closed bar, Common 414, agreed to let them do a one-time show there. Nervous about the 10 turnout, she worked hard to promote it. Her efforts paid off. By showtime, it was standing room only. The inaugural Eyes Up Here showcase in March of 2015 was a smashing success. Terry decided that night that Eyes Up Here couldn't be a one-time thing. Common 414 couldn't commit to a monthly show, so Terry approached Kings and Neptunes, both of which agreed to give her a regular show. She booked lineups of exclusively women and began encouraging curious women to try out jokes at open mics. I joked that I started doing comedy so I would stop stalking my ex-boyfriend on Facebook, says Elise Thompson, a comedian who is now an organizer and host with Eyes Up Here. Erin is very welcoming, giving stage time when I was really new. If you don't get stage time, you can't grow as a comic. And if you only do a couple of minutes here and there, you really won't grow. Erin has given me a lot of stage time, and she does that for other new and aspiring comedians. Thompson now runs her own monthly show at Bull City Cinderworks, giving stage time for short stand-up sets to emerging comedians. It's easy to applaud Terry for bringing more women comedians to the stage, but just as remarkable is that Terry took a meaningful concept and drove it to be as successful as possible. Comedians and collaborators in the Triangle note her ingenuity and doggedness for reasons for why Eyes Up Here has been so successful. Now that I have been in the comedy scene for a little while, I'm blown away, Thompson said. I'm happy doing my comedy mainly with Eyes Up Here because I know I will be supported that way. The audience is usually more engaged, bigger, and better than the other showcases that I've done that have been run by men. The ingredients that make Eyes Up Here successful is its continuing relationship with venues, persistent and welcoming promotion, and most important, how Terry grows and develops comedians. Next, Theater Transformer. LaMika Holloway Burrell is reframing the local stage. In recent years, as director of Black Ops Theater Company and the Bull City Black Theater Festival, LaMika Holloway Burrell has been a leading champion of black theater in the Triangle. As she told acclaimed Durham playwright Howard L. Kraft, a fellow alum at NC Central, the roots in black art and culture that nourish her work were planted long ago when she became a professional theater artist. They were planted growing up in the church, which was also her first taste of theater. It's the epitome of a performance space because you've got this really zealous word the preacher is going to give, and the atmosphere has to be set by praise, worship, dance, and mime. They were planted sitting around her family's kitchen table, listening to her uncle spin yarns. I appreciate all the lies I had the opportunity to witness, she says with a chuckle, because I learned so much about how to tell a good story, how to be believable. They were planted by Bruce Bridges, proprietor of the No Bookstore, which was a bastion of knowledge on Fayetteville Street for almost 20 years. Bruce was putting black books in my hand at a very early age and articulating the importance of combating white supremacy in your life through black literature. As they were planted at NC Central under the tutelage of professors such as Karen Deakins Brock and Johnny Alston, I'd like to say steel sharpens steel. They installed so much work ethic in me. I understand what it is to be a professional because of their capacity to manage their personal lives and still center their art so beautifully. A lot of character building happens for me in that department. Also, even as Dr. Olson was a technical, directing three shows, he would make time to go fishing, and that taught me the importance of self-care. Black Ops debuted in 2015 with young Jean Lee's The Shipment on an explosive indictment of American racism, co-produced by Little Green Pig Theatrical Concern. I appreciated Jay Obirsky and Dana Marks for that because we were introduced to this patron base of people who were interested in provocative theater, Holloway Burrell says. She'd been inspired to create the company while apprenticing at Cape May Stage in New Jersey. At that time, the only show on that featured black actors was Our Town, she says. I knew there could be more varieties in the way you could get to see black people on the stage. We can be doing just as poignant works by black playwrights. We don't have to be recreating Thornton Wilder. We did an Alice Childress's celebration for her centennial, and so many people had never heard of her. Black Ops is me wanting to present everything I think is missing from our local community. Another goal is to serve an audience that is far more monolithic, a challenge that makes variety all the more important. There's no way to create one piece of black art where everybody feels like they're being seen and represented. Some folks want to see Tyler Perry, and some want to see August Wilson. Some want us to do Shakespeare. Their dollars are supporting your art. That doesn't mean commercializing it, but you're trying to serve the whole community and sustain your life and practice. March's Bull City Black Theater Festival at Man Bites Dog Theater became a flashpoint in consolidating the energy Black Ops had been cultivating. Something that became very close to Black Theater community is that we need to be in conversation and collaboration with one another more often. Not just for the sheer joy that we had collaborating, but for the sustainability of all our organizations and projects. We got a glimpse of what the impact could be if you were being more intentional about programming with one another, sharing our resources, time, and talents. Monet Noel Marshall, another Indies Arts Award winner, was part of the festival. Marshall says Holloway Burrell's commitment to responsibility, community building through theater, edifies me, challenged me, and creates spaces for me and for so many others. She is a long-time game legend, Marshall said. We may not know the true impact of her work for decades yet to come. This year, Holloway Burrell joined the new Bulldog Ensemble Theater, a group of artists who frequently performed at Man Bites, the venerable Foster Street Theater that closed this year. It's bittersweet, because the other day I saw the doors of Man Bites open, but it was for construction and not because the show was happening. It's the end of an era, but it was already trickling down when Common Ground and Deep Dish closed. I made the transition to Bulldog because I don't want that light to burn out, and I'm taking this new route with Black Ops because I want to provide artists with the same sense of home that I felt from Man Bites Dog. The next article, The People's Poet. As our state's new poet laureate, Jackie Shelton Green, amplifies her life's work of literary empowerment. Jackie Shelton Green's home in Meebon is unassuming on the outside, but inside, it transports you to another place. The space is full of artifacts from her travels to Africa, South America, the Caribbean, and beyond. It's warm and welcoming, with family photos and heirlooms. It feels lived in and exudes creative, nurturing energy. You can have it all. You really can, says Green, North Carolina's ninth poet laureate, the third woman and first African-American to be appointed to the role. Since her appointment in June, she's had a full calendar, traveling nonstop for poetry readings, lectures, and other speaking engagements throughout the state. But this is business as usual for Green, who has a sort of calendar that people glance at and instinctively feel anxious. While she visits many communities of color, she is also often going into spaces where people don't expect her to go. She says she feels welcome in those spaces, but is also aware of what her presence means to people. At a recent reading in New Bern, Green says people of color brought their children to meet her because it was history. That's the energy that has been feeding me, Green said. These people who see themselves in me, that yes, I represent the people of North Carolina. Even as she carries the role of poet laureate, Green is teaching a documentary poetry course at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. She's coordinating schedules with her family and friends, and of course, carving out time to write poetry. She is also the founder of Sister Write, which brings women in space together for writing, community, sisterhood, and shared experience, and has dedicated her life to serving and teaching others in North Carolina. In fact, Green has taught people all over the world. Writer and filmmaker Wesley Broom traveled with her on a writing retreat to Morocco that she says was transformational for my creative writing. I have been blessed to have very supportive family and a tribe of writers, women, elders, mentors, and other people that are interested in me as I am in them. And I think that's what we have to do for each other. We have to keep showing up, and we have to be intentional. Born in 1953, Green grew up in Eflin and had been writing since childhood. She attended a segregated elementary school where she received public speaking instruction that helped lay the foundation for a life in front of audiences. Then she received a scholarship to the George School, a private Quaker school in Pennsylvania. Green says it was during these years that she blossomed as a writer, and many of her poems were published in the school's literary magazines. In 1977, she published her first collection, Dead on Arrival. Over the next 40 years, 7 more collections and a play, Blue Opal, have followed. Although she came home to write full-time in 2004, for most of her career, Green has been a working-class poet and public servant. She has worked in diverse sections, from the UNC Department of Agriculture to literary programs and legal services. But throughout these professional changes, she has never not done the work of teaching, writing, and advocating for the literary arts, serving on boards from the NC Arts Council to Poetry Out Loud. In 2009, she was named Piedmont Laureate, and in 2014, she was inducted into the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame. Green's accolades revealed one part of her writing life, but just as important, she has inspired and mentored countless other writers. Kenita Stringer Stanbeck, a Sister Write attendee whose grandmother taught Green in school, describes her as a great friend, mentor, an advisor, and legend. Now Green is embracing her role as an advocate for literary arts for all of North Carolina. As Poet Laureate, she can create self-initiated projects and envisions extending what she has started with Sister Write and her teaching through regional poetry salons and poetry symposiums. I really want to be out there with people, she said. It's exciting. At heart, I have all citizens in mind, and that's the beauty of this laureateship for me. But I am concerned with the communities that are underserved and isolated. For example, communities in rural western North Carolina, where there aren't a lot of people of color, in a region whose story has been vernacularized. I wonder, what are their truths, and who's recording them? And who's helping them create space for the telling of their poetry, their ballads. Poetry is always at risk of being an elite enterprise, but Green is a poet for the people, which makes her an ideal poet laureate. I'm definitely interested in the ordinariness, the everydayness of the arts, and its accessibility to all our citizens, and especially taking poetics out of the canon, she said. Many people think of poetry as Victorian poetry, or poetry that they've studied in school years ago, which did not include an array of voices, did not include what our continent looks like. I am very mindful of wanting to make space for the poetry of the non-traditional writer. In a way, the role is just an official recognition of what Green has been doing all of her life. As Ed Southern, the North Carolina Writers Network Executive Director, notes, Jackie's been doing the work of a poet laureate for years, using poetry to connect people, or maybe more accurately, to make people see how they've been connected all along. The next article, Fashion Forward. Runaway is ending after this season, but its 7 years in Durham leaves a legacy that won't end anytime soon. Clothing was really just a vehicle to push forward the scene that we wanted to create, says Gabrielle Ingetz, the founder and creative director of the Durham and Proud of It fashion brand Runway. It was the thing that actually made the money to do all of the fun things that we wanted to do. Ang Getz sent shockwaves through the Triangle Arts community in November when he announced that Runway's Winter 2018 collection would be its last, bookending a prolific run for a clothing line that served a much larger purpose for Bull City. Over the past 7 years, Runway functioned as a multifaceted platform, a nexus of creative interest that ultimately brought people together in ways unparalleled by most local street brands. And it's accomplished all of that through choices that have intentionally honored the history of Durham in ways both big and small. In January, after 2 successful years on West Main Street, Runway will close the doors of its brick-and-mortar location as its team moves on to different projects and endeavors. When the brand first started out, we felt that the scene in Durham was really not where we wanted to be, Inget said. But instead of just going to New York or Los Angeles, we decided, let's just try to create it here. We were young kids, but how do you convince people that they can stay here, making amazing things, and how do you share that with the public, and ideally, the world? Ingetz and his team pursued this vision from different vantage points, producing and collaborating on art shows, podcasts, concerts, and documentaries. They saw Runway outside of the limited framework of a fashion line and more as an art and lifestyle brand that informed Durham creatives, as Ingetz puts it. It was all a way to capture the subculture of art, music, and fashion here in Durham in a way that had never really been done or captured before through the media. The brand was born in 2011 in Ingetz's basement through clothes he screen-printed with six-color, six-head printing press. A Durham native, he'd recently returned home after earning an art degree from Syracuse and developing an interest in fashion during his 4 years in New York. Inget says he launched Runway as a way to reconnect with the Triangle Arts community, which he'd previously dabbled in during high school. Runway exploded in 2012 with the launch of its locally iconic Durham, imaginary a nod to Durham authenticity, and allowed Ingetz to build Runway into an influential community institution while paying tribute to the hometown that he loved. Ingetz began to honor the legacy of the Bull City through his products in other ways. While the design of the Durham skyline may seem like low-hanging fruit, the incorporation of Black Wall Street into his clothing acknowledged and honored a history of racial tension and inequality in this part of North Carolina. One of Runway's last projects is also intimately intertwined with the city's history. The crew interviewed and photographed a number of Durham OGs, people like former Mayor Bill Bell and local barber Akeen Miller, who grew up and charted a positive path to success in Durham, and plan to share the interviews on its website and social media channels in late December. All of these people have been in Durham forever, Ingetz says. A big part of the brand has always been that we want to create clothing for people who really are invested in the city and who have been here for a while. But we also are making clothing for people who just moved here, whether they're moving back or new residents or Duke students or whatever. The only thing is, we really want them to know the history of the city. We were lucky to get him for the 7 years that we did, says Pierce Freeland, a friend of Ingetz and the founder of the Afrofuturism digital marketplace Blackspace. Gabe has an increasing talent, and Runway was an opportunity, from my perspective, to see his talents on the canvases of the people of Durham. If Durham is nothing else, it's multifaceted and multi-layered and multi-talented. The last award winner, Art Ambassador. Over a quarter century, Larry Wheeler put NCMA on the world stage. Damian Stamer still remembers his first meeting with Larry Wheeler. The Durham painter, whose landscapes of rural southern homesteads focus on memory, impermanence, and place, was scarcely a year out of his MFA at UNC Chapel Hill in May of 2014 when he invited the director of the North Carolina Museum of Art to his first solo show of large-scale works at Raleigh's Flanders Gallery. It was a major gut check, he recalls. I had no idea what he'd think. I had never gone to a show of mine with a museum director before. After touring the exhibition, Wheeler invited Stamer to lunch at Iris's, the light-infused restaurant on the museum's Blue Ridge Road campus. Somewhere between courses, Wheeler told him the museum would acquire a work from his exhibition. For me, it was like winning the lottery, Stamer said. It was the first museum I'd ever visited. It felt like coming full circle. Stacy Lynn Waddell, a Raleigh native who indelibly marks her multimedia interrogations of historical figures and landscapes with branding tools, gilding, and lasers, first met Wheeler after her first museum commission in 2010. It was an encounter with an undeniable ball of energy, fire, and passion, she said. I didn't expect to have a relationship. Not because with the museum's chief curator, but the director himself. I certainly didn't expect I would come to think of him as a mentor. There's no shortage of monumental benchmarks in Larry Wheeler's career. He has helped shape NCMA not only during the 24 years as its director, but literally as well supervising the construction of the first building of what is now the museum's 164-acre campus while serving the Department of Cultural Resources Deputy Secretary from the late 1970s to the mid-1980s. He returned to the region in 1994 after 9 years as developmental director for the Cleveland Museum of Art, as a man with a flair for broad gestures, an appetite for risk, and an insatiable curiosity for all elements of the artistic process, a definite departure from the museum's previously introverted leadership. Several defining moves followed thereafter. An audacious personal appearance at Christie's auction in New York, where he dueled with a telephone bidder before buying a significant new work by German expressionist Anselm Kiefer, construction of Picture This, an amphitheater on the grounds outside the Tate Museum, incorporating a new work by conceptual artist Barbara Kruger. Lavish parties where he courted new business leaders in Raleigh and Research Triangle Park, as well as Jones Street politicians. Capping them all was a series of increasingly ambitious blockbuster exhibitions, calculated not only to generate local and regional interest, but also to put the museum on the national and international map. The museum's audacious Festival Rodin in 2000, the largest exhibition anywhere of the artist in 20 years, reached out beyond the museum doors, collaborating with other regional arts organizations, including Carolina Ballet, which commissioned a choreographic evening of tableau vivants, Rodin, Miss Envy. More than 300,000 people visited that expedition. When that achievement proved that the arts were an economic force to be reckoned with, further growth became inevitable. NCMA made plans to double its size with a world-class second building. Those plans helped secure groundbreaking bequests in turn, a gift of 30 Rodin sculptures from the Iris and B. Gerald Cantor Foundation, making the museum the third largest Rodin depository in the U.S., and 100 works of 20th century painting and sculpture from the Patton Foundation. Exhibition and events followed that were calibrated to bring in audiences who had never been to the museum. A 2013 showing of mint-condition porches and a celebration of Art Deco automobiles tilted the museum's traditionally female-heavy demographics. films and concerts at the amphitheater, and edgy contemporary art exhibitions like Zero to 60, and this year's insanely popular You Are Here, appealed to a younger audience. In 2016, Museum Park Initiative was permanently taken, and the museum took the museum to its building beyond its building walls, making art available over 3 miles of walking trails every day of the year. Upon Wheeler's retirement last month, he left a museum that 500,000 people have visited this year with a projected income of $24 million. Among such monumental benchmarks, it's easy to lose sight of Wheeler's long-term support of local artists. As chief curator Linda Johnson-Doherty says, it isn't every museum director who visits the studios of local artists and MFA students as often as he frequently professionals in the New York. He does it at a relentless pace, Doherty said. He always has. And local artists like Stammer and Waddell appreciated it. You spend a lot of time alone in a studio, and there comes a point where you can feel so disconnected, Waddell said. When someone like Larry comes in, that conversation creates a bridge between you and the outside world. To have him come in and say, I see you. I see what you're doing. And it's as rigorous as important as what I see at the top levels of your discipline. That helps that isolation and hard work feels like it's going in the right direction because he believes in the work and it pushes you to work harder and to go farther. Now a quick look for the back talk. The simplest solution. A few weeks ago, Lee Taus noted that Republicans in Wake County seem to be an endangered species, shut out of countywide offices and left with only one member in the legislative delegation. Joshua Peters responded, I wouldn't say Wake County Republicans are endangered species per se. Rather, they are significantly outnumbered by their Democratic counterparts. As someone who would classify himself as a liberal Republican, I definitely think the only way for Republicans to be successful in counties like Wake, Durham, and Mecklenburg is to differentiate themselves from their conservative peers, though this may categorize them, more or less, as closeted libertarians. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. So until next week, this is goodbye, good night, and good morning.